happen. What you've got to look at is the dipole itself is a flywheel-like structure. You're putting energy into it. The energy is going to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. And to make all those bounces fall co-phase in step with each other, we call that resonance. If the electrical lengths are just right, all the bounces stay in phase with each other, and the thing radiates with a resistive impedance. It doesn't give you a phase shift of reactance if it's too short, which would be a capacitor, and if it's too long, it'll be an inductor, because the signal bounces back too late, if you know what I mean. We call that inductance. Okay, so you don't have to feed it in the center. You don't have to make it physically a half wave long if you're willing to use zigzag loading coils, tap hat capacitors. There's nothing magic about the right side of the dipole and the left side of the dipole being the same diameter. You could decide to make the right side of the dipole out of 14 gauge wire, make the left side of the dipole out of a 4-inch diameter piece of copper tubing if you want to, and it'll work like a charm. Physically, it may be very difficult to live with. Once you start building UHF antennas with tape, you have the ability to make the tape as wide as you want, zigzag it any way you want, put notch repeater, time out. Once again, once you're using copper tape as the elements of an antenna on a UHF frequency, you can make the right side and the left side big and small, wide, narrow, zigzag, slots, notches, other kinds of cuts in it, whatever. There's all kinds of ways you can do it. The way you physically lay out the dipole is your choice, and there's various advantages for doing it. The Yagi that I repatented in 2003, a three-element 915 megahertz Yagi. How in the world did I, 75 years later, after Mr. Hindu Subhu Yagi patented the Yagi antenna, how in the world did I re-patent an antenna? By making enough changes that were not obvious. And the changes were building it out of copper foil, making the elements of the dipole extremely wide, like an eighth of a wavelength wide. The average person thinks that a Yagi only works well if all of the parasitic elements are narrow in width so that they're high in Q. They think high Q is where the gain is coming from. Absolutely not. They're afraid to make the elements wide for fear they're going to shadow each other. Absolutely not. Kent, WA5VJB, entered an antenna gain contest one day where he built a Simone antenna, a cigar antenna as it's called, where each of the parasitic elements were made out of a CD-ROM disc. He had a dowel going down the center to support these discs. Each of these discs, he had nibbled the perimeter of them a little bit with a nibbling tool to make them the right diameter. And so he had a series of discs as the parasitic elements. Common sense would lead you to believe that that as a Yagi would be terrible, because that great big shadow of each one of them would mean that the signal never gets down to the driven element. It worked like a charm. Had a beautiful antenna. Broader in bandwidth, independent of repeater. Time out. Beautiful in bandwidth, independent of polarization. The polarization only depended on whether or not the driven element was a horizontal or vertical dipole. And he could have made it both if he wanted to. And so what I'm getting at is, as you build a Yagi antenna, a dipole antenna, you don't have to feed it in the center. The left side and the right side doesn't have to be the same diameter. It doesn't have to be the same width. There's lots and lots of ways of doing it. You can choose almost any shape you want. If you're a real good antenna designer, there's probably 100 different ways you can install a hidden antenna onto an automobile. Every single slot in the sheet metal that you cut could be a slotted dipole antenna that you cover over with epoxy and paint, and you'll never see it. Every slot between the fender and the body of the car, the side view mirror versus the rest of the car, can be a ground plane. You can build a quarter wave shorted, what is it now called, a ridge waveguide horn into what looks like the loudspeaker assembly for the rear view, for the rear window of the car. You can build a slotted waveguide antenna in there that you would never see. There's a zillion ways you can put an antenna on a plainclothes car that you would never know there's an antenna there. If you study the right chapters of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, particularly the chapters on slotted antennas, you'll get some hints about this. If you look at the book by, I can't think of the guy's name right now, it's called Frequency Selective Surfaces. You look at the book called Frequency Selective Surfaces, and you realize that if you start off with a flat sheet of metal and cut cuts into the sheet of metal that are in the shape of a dipole, a French cross, an ordinary Christian cross, there's lots and lots of ways you can make...
Repeater, time out.
My goodness, am I good at timing out the machine tonight? There's lots and lots of ways you can make all kinds of slots and zigzags and whatever into that sheet of metal and make it into a beautiful antenna if that's what you want to do. So the trapezoidal ground plane is a good way of going. It looks to me like it made a lower Q antenna that had a smaller amount of coupling coefficient into the 2-meter antenna. Therefore, the tuning of the two was a little bit more independent. And I wonder, from the picture you probably have now, John, did the radiator on the 440 and the radiator on the 2 meters, are they a little bit non-parallel to each other in order to decouple them? I recommend that. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, they are in line with each other, but the 440 is above the transmitting element is above the 2-meter element. The 2-meter is lower on the shade. So that is the way it was originally also. But interesting looking thing. And he's done so well with this. Now he's going to follow your advice. He's going to develop a Yagi because he can pull the shade in a horizontal fashion. So he's going to put a 440, just a 440 antenna, on the shade and see how that works as a Yagi. That might do very well for him also. But he wanted to thank us.
He's got an extremely good idea there for the Yagi. And I'll eventually find the exact patent number where he can look at my Yagi patent, and it'll give him ideas. Once you're starting off with sheet metal, like pieces of copper tape and aluminum tape and whatever, and laying them out on a dielectric material. I was laying them out on sheets of fiberglass. He's laying it out on the paper, so to speak, or the fiberglass, whatever it is, of the shade. He can build Yagis out of that. He has, in my opinion, John, a very good commercial product there. Once he does a little bit more development, there's lots and lots of people who live in an apartment building. The wife won't let him put up an antenna. The landlord or the supervisor of the building won't let him put up an antenna. But he's got shades on the window that can be rolled down, or he's going to be going to a vacation site or a foreign country or whatever, and he brings his roller shade with him, and therefore he can establish an antenna anywhere he wants. There is a need for that very portable. Let me drop. There's a need for that portable antenna. In my opinion, he is sitting on a commercial product that he should develop. I don't think there's enough uniqueness here that's not obvious to file for a patent. I'm not sure he's going to be able to get intellectual property control by way of a patent. I said I'm not sure. It's possible, depending on what little doodads he adds to this. See, in order for a patent to really be an invention, it's got to be useful, different, non-obvious. It's got to be a different way of doing things that are not quite obvious, and it's got to be useful. He's got something that's damn useful, a little bit unique, not necessarily obvious. He's on the threshold of a patent, in my opinion. And so he's definitely got a commercial product there. And depending on how far that shade can be stretched out, he can make at least on 440, he can probably make a 3, 4, or 5 element Yagi. On 220 or 900 megs or 1296, he can build a whole lot of zillion elements of the Yagi. And he's probably going to worry a little bit that when he stretches out the shade horizontally, let me drop it. He's going to worry about the sag in the shade stopping the Yagi action. And as Barry Into Mike Bravo brought to our attention last week or the weekend before, you'd be amazed how much sag you can have of the boom of a Yagi, and it still behaves like a chaw. It can, to the human eye, can look really homely by way of the sag or the U-shape and whatever of the boom, and it's still a Yagi, because the Yagi consists of a number of parasitic elements, where the parasitic elements have a particular resonant frequency and approximately the right position in space. And the Yagi is very forgiving for a vertical displacement of those individual elements along that boom. So, and whether or not he builds some kind of a support structure, like a simple piece of slat of wood that you attach to the shade when you stretch it out horizontal to make it look completely flat and horizontal, those are minor details of what he can add. But from my point of view, he is sitting on an extremely good, useful product, and there's a good number of hands out there that, in my opinion, will buy that, John. KC2WGB, I hope you tell him that. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I will. I'm sure I'll hear from him again, especially on this Yagi. By the way, Dick, the shades that he can buy, they're dirt cheap, and he can get them any length. The ones he's working with are 5 feet long. So that's a lot of area, but he can get them longer if he needs it. And they're made out of Mylar. What could be better?
Yeah, Mylar is an extremely good dielectric material to build antennas out of. The only thing that's slightly better is Teflon. And Teflon's expensive. Stick with the Mylar. Yeah, Mylar's a good material. And the chimneys for the air exhaust tubes on the parallel kilowatt amplifier with the parallel cooling air arrangement, they were made out of Mylar. They were literally drafting material from the drafting department of the company I was working for at the time, cut up with scissors and taped together just right to make a Mylar tube. And the only thing wrong with Mylar is that the heat of a 4CX250B does eventually start discoloring the Mylar, and it looks a little bit homely. It gets brown spots, if you know what I mean. It can't take the 250 degrees Fahrenheit that the tube is able to dish out. But Mylar is a great material, and yeah, that should work like a charm. And so I guess he's going to keep communicating with you as that product gets developed, and I think he's on a very good path. From what you can tell, is this guy an engineer? What do you believe is his background, John? He's an interesting person. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
He's a painter. But he's really into electronics. Doesn't have much equipment, but he's working with very basic meters and tools, and he's struggling, but he's accomplishing. He has the 2 meter and 440 working, and he'll probably have that Yagi working. And what's great about the Mylar, at first I didn't know it was Mylar. I thought it was window shade material, but it's window shade material Mylar, and it's opaque. I think it's a white opaqueness, it looks like. But the glue on the aluminum tape sticks tenaciously to it, and he has a tough time peeling it off. So I think it's going to work out really well for him. And exactly what you said, he realized from your discussions about Yagis, about the elements don't have to be perfectly aligned. You can have a little sag in the boom. He heard that discussion, and that's what brought him to mind, because he thought when he stretched it out, he'd have to put support structures and stuff. He says he can pull it pretty tight, not much could trip, maybe an inch and 4 feet in the center, so that shouldn't bother him at all. KC2WGB.
Yeah, that amount of droop in the center is only physical eye beauty, if you know what I mean. The radio wave doesn't see it. You'll get some great ideas about a tape dipole into a Yagi if he reads that patent and looks at the pictures that go along with it. I'm going to have to get you the number for the patent. I'm going to try to do that in the later version of this TechNet. And he could find it right now by going to my call letters, K2RIW, finding out the spelling of my name. And there's a way you can go to the patent office and do a search for inventor on that name. And you'll see the patents that were issued in that name. You'll get a little bit confusion because my last name happens to have two guys who, by the way, are remotely related to each other. There's a guy named Kevin, first name, and a guy named Richard, first name. I'm the guy Richard, and there's a guy named Kevin, who's also got a whole bunch of patents on printed circuit generating techniques. But if you look at around 2003, 2004, let's see, now that's when I filed. I'm not sure when it was issued. Maybe it was 2005, 2006. But they're all issued when you go to the website of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and you do a search on inventor's name and you properly spell it, and you got to use only the last name, because the first name, sometimes it's Richard T, sometimes it's Richard. And so you got to use just the last name, if you know what I mean, to do the search. You'll find that particular patent. And when you look at the photograph of the actual layout of the printed, of the copper tape, let me drop. When you look at the layout of the copper tape, it'll give you a whole lot of ideas on how wide can the elements be, how you feed the driven element. In other words, there's a way that with the copper tape, the driven element becomes the impedance matching structure and balun all wrapped into one. And it's using the idea of Kent, of A5EJB, who patented that technique for what you and I would call a half of a folded dipole. Half folded dipole feed is what he literally patented. And his patent is one of the things that's used as previous intellectual source of material for that particular patent of mine. So Kent and I are linked together by our patents, if you know what I mean. So I strongly recommend he use copper tape if he can get a hold of it, because soldering to it to connect the coaxial cable becomes very easy. Aluminum tape, soldering to it is very difficult. However, there is a way around that. Let me drop. Possibly the aluminum tape he can get a hold of. He can get a whole lot of it in his hands very inexpensively, and the copper tape is going to cost him a lot. Maybe that's it. And there's a way around this. He can lay out the whole Don antenna in aluminum tape, and only in the places where he's got to make electrical contact, he lays down copper tape on top of the aluminum tape. The copper tape is easy to solder to. If the pads of copper tape laying on top of the aluminum tape, even with the glue in between, which is an insulator, if the area of the copper tape laying on the top of the aluminum tape is great enough, it is an extremely good electrical contact at UHF frequencies. And if you're smart enough in the way you design the impedance matching, even the little bit of series capacitive reactance of the glue between the copper tape and the aluminum tape, that could be part of the tuning of the antenna. And I've done that, and it works like a charm. In fact, when I make copper dipoles, and I need to make a variable capacitor in the center, there are times when I've laid the copper tape across the center, the gap in the center, on top of each other. I've done it with a piece of scotch tape on one side to make sure I've got a clearly defined capacitor, if you know what I mean. There are times when I forgot the scotch tape, and it still sort of worked. You got to be careful, though. Occasionally, a little sharp edge of the copper tape will dig through the glue and make direct electrical contact. You don't have a capacitor anymore. So you're much better off. If you really want to design a capacitor, then lay down some scotch tape before you lay down the copper tape. But still, you can make that part of the intentional series reactance for the impedance matching at that location. There's a zillion ways you can use tape to make VHF, UHF antennas, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I can tell somebody else wanted to sign in. Now, who was that?
Stuart, comment on the tape.
You said it very fast. It sounded like end-to-end. Give us the call letters again, and go ahead with the tape on top of the tape. Give us your name also, K2LIW.
US2N, Paul. No, a comment on the tape, Dick. How copy you? Should I go to the other repeater?
You sound beautiful, Paul. Go right ahead.
I've never tried using copper or aluminum tape as an antenna, but making the connections, if you have like these alarm the windows, they don't use them anymore, but I have them, and originally they were done in lead tape, and now I use aluminum tape. And anytime something breaks, or a window breaks, or something has to be changed, you can take the new aluminum tape and put it right over the other tape, you could use any kind of glue you want, even the, you know, super glue or anything. You know, you burn it over about 2 or 3 inches, and then you take a needle, any kind of a needle, you know, that you would sew something with, and you just put like a million little tiny holes, just, you know, tap it over and over again in that area where it overlies the other one, and boy, what a good contact you get. That was shown to me by an old timer that used to install these lead tape, Dick. Back to you.
Fantastic, Paul. That's very crafty. By poking a zillion little holes with a sewing needle or a straight pin, each place you pierce the upper tape, if you looked at it microscopically with a good microscope, you're folding a piece of conductor from the upper layer through the glue layer into the lower layer. And so I'm guessing that 50% of them, you're folding the upper conductor into the lower conductor, and it's going to make contact. And if you poke 50 holes and 25 of them are making contact, you've got a darn good low ohmic contact between the two. Is that approximately what's going on, Paul? Very crafty idea. WS2N, K2RIW on the tech man.
Yeah, exactly. The aluminum tape has a gluing effect to it, so you put it right on, but I put a little extra blast on it, you know, to really attach it. I've probably done it 20 or 30 times in my house over the years, you know, and never once a failure, not once. I assume it's going to work real good for RF. Thank you, Dick.
V3ZTZ, comment.
Very fine, Paul. Now let's see how those guys up there in the Golden Horseshoe of Canada, let's see how they solve that problem. What's the Canadian solution to this one, Scott? P3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Glad to hear from you.
Well, I know you're busy and you get your 300 emails a week and everything else, but if you recall back in the winter time frame there, I had asked you about this, and I have on my window a 5/8 wave over 5/8 wave dipole in copper foil with a quarter wave copper foil up perpendicular to 5/8 wave dipole for my UHF on my window, and in fact that's what I'm transmitting on right now with an HT. The way I solved the join, I have tried soldering and with a silicone pad lift the tape up, lay it down to where you want it, lift it up again, put a silicone pad under and touch solder it. That works, but it's got its problems. So what I settled on was silver epoxy. I run the copper foil tape out, fold it back on a 45 degree angle where the two sides meet, and then just dab the seam with silver epoxy. Seems to work just fine. V3ZTZ, back to that.
Scott, that sounds like a very crafty antenna you're using. If you had some spare time someday, and you took a photograph of that, and mailed it to me, and I in turn sent it to Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, who is a guy who maintains the website by which people who sign into this TechNet can go to that website and look at the photographs or look at the URL that we're talking about so that we're all on the same page. I'd like to do that. So take your time, but if you got a chance to make a photograph of that very crafty antenna on your window, and you called it UHF, which I presume either means 450 or 1296, I'd like to see it. VE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think we could arrange that. And yes, by UHF, I mean 70 centimeters, 440.
Okay, no hurry, but I'd appreciate it. And so these hams are very crafty, and nowadays it's not quite like it was in 1940. In 1940, almost any ham that wanted a transmitter, he had to build it. There was essentially very few of them available, and a few commercial products, but they were very pricey. And nowadays, nobody builds an 80 through 10 meter sideband transceiver. Nobody builds a 2 meter all mode transceiver. transceiver, and so on. But when it comes to antennas, that's where we shine. And so there's lots and lots of crafty ways. You open up the pages of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Early versions were by Jasek. The later versions were by Jasek and Johnson. And the latest version is by Vlasic, the fourth edition or the fifth edition, whichever it is. You open that up and you'll find out there's 5,000 kinds of antennas in my mind, 5,000. And no matter how many you think are there, when it comes to these various ways of making tape Yagis, tape dipoles, there's 28 patent applications in my name these days for various antenna, what I think are innovations. And one third of them have already been issued by the patent office. So here I am, 100 years downrange, 150 years downrange from Heinrich Hertz inventing the dipole antenna, and I'm filing patents on antennas. So even though there's 5,000 more, eventually maybe there's going to be 5,028, if you know what I mean. So there's lots and lots of ways that we hams can come up with very crafty ways of building antennas. And so what this guy that John is communicating with, I think you said he's a painter, which reminds me, in the early days, let me drop.
I don't think he's an artist. I think he's a house painter, Dick. I'm not sure.
Yeah, one of the most active guys on the 432 megacycle band in 1970, way back in the dark ages, when 432 was considered really high microwave. I mean, that was in never frequencies in those days. The most active guy on the 432 meg band at that time, his occupation was he was a violin tuner and a piano tuner. That was his occupation. And why can't I think of his call letters right now? Why can't I think of his name? Lived in the Hempstead area, and he was building cubical quad antennas on 432 with five and six elements to them. And he was sending signals to me, and I was telling him how many microvolts he's giving me today and how many microvolts it was better than yesterday when he made that modification to the antenna. We were having a grand old time with this in 1970 to 1975. I'll eventually think of his call letters and name. Unfortunately, he's a silent key. So some of the guys who've done some of the best work are not necessarily in the field, if you know what I mean. They're just curious. And that's where it happens, curiosity. KC2WGV, go with your next one. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
KC2WGV. Dick, do you have a pencil and piece of paper in front of you?
I'm ready to draw. Fire away.
Okay. This guy is serious. This is an antenna also. What a project. It's going to sound like an abortion, but when you see it drawn out, it's pretty clever. All right. We have 2-inch galvanized pipes. They're 40 feet long. There's two of them. They're separated by 90 feet. Okay. There's a north one and a south one. Okay. Now, starting from north of the north pipe, at a 45 degree angle, he has a guy wire going up to the pipe, runs across to the other pipe, and then back down at 45 degrees into the ground. That's his support structure. On top of both pipes, he has verticals, okay? He's got a 6-meter, 10-meter arrangement on one pipe, and he's got a 2-meter, 440 on the other pipe. Okay, got that so far?
Sort of. I'm not sure. I know that there's a pair of 40-foot-long galvanized pipes, essentially parallel to each other, separated by 90 feet, and then when you said up and down in guy wire, it now wasn't clear anymore. Are they going up to a tree to hold them off the ground, up to a tower? The word up and down becomes a little bit confusing. Are these pipes parallel to the ground, some number of feet above the ground, and now he's going to add these other antennas to them? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I'll just redo that. Okay, these pipes that are 40 feet long, they're perpendicular, they're stuck in the ground, they're in 3 feet. So you've got 37 feet, roughly, sticking out of the ground. So from the actual surface of the earth, the top of the pipe is roughly 37 feet. Now, there's a north pipe and a south pipe.
approximately 30 feet north of the north pipe, he has a ground shoe, which has a stainless steel guy wire. Travels up to the top of the first pole, the north pole, at the 37-foot level. Then it runs across for the 90 feet to the second pole, secured there, then runs down at a 45-degree angle to another spoon in the ground with a turnbuckle there. Okay, the two pipes are held are also fastened with ground rods as well as that supporting structure wire. Then you have the four antennas, two on each pole. All right, does that make better sense?
Yeah, when you said the two pipes are perpendicular, it meant they're both perpendicular to the ground, parallel to each other, both sticking straight up, 40 feet long, 3 feet in the ground, 37 feet up, 90 feet separated, the 45-degree guy wire up to each one, the 90 wire across them. I see that so far. And I think you're telling me now, on the top of each one of these pipes, he's going to mount various kinds of antennas. Go right ahead, John. K2LAW.
Exactly right, Dick. Vertical antennas, 2-meter 440 combo, and on the other pole is going to be a 6-meter and 10-meter combo antennas. And those are working, and they're up and running. Now I'll go, let me let it drop, and then I'll go to the other construct. KC2WGB. Okay. Now, in the fashion of a flagpole, he has a lanyard, which is a continuous loop, one on each pole. There's a pulley at the top, a pulley at the bottom, and the lanyard runs through the pulleys. And, okay, what he's going to do with this is, he has positions for 3 8 insulators on each one. He's going to have, I believe, what's going to be an 80-meter, 40-meter, and a 20-meter antenna, one below the other, all in line. They will have a ballon in the center, and the antennas leaving left and right. And he will be able to lower all three antennas with the lanyards up and down. His question is, let me let it drop. He must have 100 of these 5-inch egg insulators. He's got them everywhere. But here's his question. Should he space the antennas, because he only has 5-inch egg insulators, will 5-inch spacing between the 80-40-20 be sufficient, or should he put two spacers on the 20-meter so that it would be 10 inches below the 40-meter antenna? And this is all going to be fed with coax RG8U, and he also notices that he's using this, it's all stainless steel, this stuff. And that stainless steel wire that runs over the top and secured at both ends is going to afford him what he thinks is going to be pretty good lightning protection.
The egg insulator in between the tips of collinear antennas, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10, or whatever, constitutes a coupling capacitor. And whether he uses 1, 2, or 3 egg insulators means he has, let me pick a number, a 30, a 15, or a 7.5 gigafarad coupling capacitor. No matter what he does, there's a coupling capacitor between the two, and therefore it's part of the tuning of the antenna. As long as the individual antenna he cares about resonates on that particular frequency electronically, its mechanical length is slightly secondary, as long as it electronically resonates with that coupling capacitor, it will radiate very well. As I've said to Don many times, that's not written in any book that I've ever seen. Any reasonable antenna that we're going to build on the frequencies we ham radio operators care about, you resonate the antenna first, then it radiates well. You violate that, you make it a non-resonant antenna, with rare exception of rhombic and beverage, it's not going to radiate well. And rhombic and beverage can get away with that, non-resonant, because they're a zillion wavelengths long. When it comes to our half-wave and one-wave type antennas, you must resonate it, because the energy you put into the antenna, let me drop, the energy you put into the antenna is going to bounce back and forth a whole lot of times, before it gets radiated, and you want all of those bounces to stay co-phase. It's very similar to using your finger to push your daughter on a swing. You've got to have the timing of your pushes just right. You get the timing wrong, and she's not going to swing very far. By the same type, and that timing, in the case of an antenna, we call it resonance. You want those bounces to all stay in step with each other. Therefore, you build up some nice energy, which is a large amount of current. The current creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field around the antenna begins the radiation process. And one of my personally held philosophies is the majority of radiation is magnetic. We talk about the electrical component, and I think it's minor. But that's just me, and everyone's going to agree with that one. That's controversial. So one, two, or three egg insulators, that's his choice. In either case, he's going to have to do some tuning. And there's various ways you can find out whether or not they're hitting resonance. And the piece of wire he's got over the top of those structures does constitute a extremely good, let me drop, extremely good lightning arrestor. You'll notice that in many of the distribution power wiring in many communities, you've got the three main power wires for the distribution going down the telephone poles. They're sometimes 13.8 kilovolts, sometimes other numbers, A phase, B phase, and C phase, and they in turn go to the pole peg transformer, one of those phases, to ground, and 13-point-something kilovolts on the primary becomes 240 volts on the secondary with center tap, and that goes to your house. Well, on many of those distribution poles, you'll see at the very top of the poles, a wire strung between all the poles that is not the A, B, or C phase. It's the lightning arrestor phase that periodically on various poles, it's got a piece of 6-gauge wire that goes down the side of the pole into the butt plate at the bottom of the pole. That's the grounding of the system. And so the whole philosophy is that you've got a tremendous amount of area of all of that distribution wiring of the power in any community. It's a huge target for lightning. But if you can make the most desirable target, that upper wire that's grounded, and if 99% of the time the lightning strikes the upper wire and not the other 13.2 kilovolt wires, you're a hell of a lot better off. So by that philosophy, he's got it made. Also, the fire protection code for New York City does state that there is no documented evidence of a habitable building that's alongside of a well-grounded radio tower having ever been struck with lightning. Let me drop. And if you go to the Polyphaser company that makes these lightning arrestor-like devices, and you order their manual on lightning, you'll get a whole lot of information about how you can take a theoretical sphere that, as I remember, is 130 feet in diameter or something like that. You stack this theoretical sphere into various locations alongside of your radio tower, and as long as the antenna of question is inside of that sphere, so to speak, then the tower that's well grounded alongside of it will give you protection. There's various ways you can evaluate how effective is your lightning protection, and the Polyphaser lightning book will give you a lot of information on that. So from what I'm hearing, that's a very good lightning arrestor. We know that no lightning arrestor is perfect. No matter what you do, once per thousand strikes, lightning is going to bypass everything you've got and still strike your antenna. So it's going to give you a lot of protection. Know that nothing is perfect. And it sounds pretty good to me. It's a darn good attempt, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, the best part he loves about this system is it takes up hardly any room at all. It's running parallel with the edge of his property, so he's not bothering anybody with it. But along with that, he has additional fasteners on the lanyards. He can run up slopers. He can make X antennas. He can do so much with this system. It's and he's got most of it up. He was just worried about when he runs these three horizontal dipoles that the spacing between them is the only thing that he was concerned about. He thought that the 20 meter might be might have to be a little lower than the below the 40 than the 40 is below the 80. That was the thing that was bothering. But sounds like he's going to do great with this.
John, I'm going to ask you if you got a third one you want to give us. And Who is the person who just broke in? Give me a call letters and name once more. Sorry to say, you're only there 5% of the time, so we didn't get a full set of call letters. So, go on with your third one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, it's after 10:30. Let's go on to Paul, and I'm going to hold the other one I have until next week and add some more to it. But thank you for those answers. I'm sure they, both of these guys are doing very well. And like you said, innovation. They're not in the field, but they're producing some wonderful things. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
And for the few guys who have got a tall enough tree, a tall enough tower, or whatever, so that you can put up a sloper or pure vertical, whichever you like, pure vertical or sloper half-wave dipole, you'll be amazed what performance you get out of it. It's an extremely unpopular antenna because in the training manuals, it's never shown. The training manuals show you a half-wave dipole straight out, flat, parallel to the ground at some particular altitude. And if you make a pure vertical half-wave piece of continuous wire with no egg insulator in the center, and you feed it at the bottom with reference to ground, and you have a simple L network of one inductor, one capacitor in series going to ground between the feed line, and at the junction between the two, you go to the antenna. You properly select that L and C so that it's an L network, giving you an impedance step up of 50 ohms from your transmission line to roughly 1,500 ohms for the outer edge of the dipole, and you feed that as a pure vertical dipole. As a previous guy did that. I'm trying to think of his call letters all of a sudden. I'm terrible.
2KUY, Mel.
Yeah, my mind's going blank. The guy's only a silent key for a short period of time. Mel, K2KEY. I built that out in front of his house in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, and boy, that worked like a charm. What's magic about that antenna is that when you're trying to build a quarter-wave ground plane, in order to have the proper counterpoise, you're trying to reproduce the second half of the dipole with the ground plane. You got to lay down a zillion radials, and even then does a quasi good job because the whole antenna is by definition very close to the ground. You make it a half-wave dipole vertical above the ground, fed at the bottom. Because you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance of the half-wave antenna, as opposed to a 30 ohm impedance for the quarter-wave antenna, the ground plane radials are not required. The best way to make a counterpoise is a quarter wavelength of another half of a dipole. That's what you're basically doing. You don't need ground plane radials. A simple ground rod is more than good enough. You get 90-some-odd percent efficiency out of this antenna. The phase center is twice as high above the ground as it would be with a ground plane. The raw materials are inexpensive. And vertical polarization versus horizontal polarization doesn't give you phase reversal on ground reflection. You automatically, therefore, get a very low angle of radiation, even though the antenna is not very many wavelengths above the ground. You get a lot of bang for the dollar out of that antenna, whether it be a sloper or a pure vertical. And the fact that it's running parallel to the trunk of your tree with a whole lot of sap in it, don't worry about that. Space it a little bit away from the tree if you want to. But the tree is just part of the tuning assembly, if you know what I mean. With the right kind of an antenna tuner or the right setting of that L network at the bottom, it's going to fly. Now, the more I read about alpha magnetic spectrometer, let me drop. I had some of the numbers wrong last week. It has measured something like 30 billion events of cosmic rays, very high power cosmic rays hitting it. 400,000 of those are these positrons, in other words, antimatter electrons. 400,000 events. Quite a few of them way up there at 350 giga electron volts. Really potent amount of energy. To launch that much energy into the lightest thing in the world, an electron, requires a lot of boosting power. The biggest thing we've got on planet Earth, the Large Hadron Collider, can't come close to putting that much energy into an electron. Mother Nature is doing that, and she did it 400,000 times. so the total number of positrons that mankind has detected has gone up by hundreds of times once they put this alpha magnetic spectrometer in space. And it's too bad they weren't able to put the superconducting magnet on it, which means it would have even gone to higher power yet. Right now it's got a 7-ton neodymium magnet. I thought it could make this thing work. 7 tons. But what a piece of machinery. And can that, it measures the direction of arrival, it measures the amount of energy, and it measures the polarity of things that hit it. And that's the kind of data it's collecting. And they're now speculating, is it seeing dark matter? Is it seeing the emission of neutron stars? Is it seeing supernovas? Is it seeing the antimatter that exists outside of our particular solar system or outside of our galaxy? It got all kinds of speculations. I think all of that missing antimatter, that was supposed to be 50% matter and 50% antimatter at the instant of the Big Bang. And for years everybody's been asking, where's all the antimatter? Well, in this particular solar system, and maybe this particular galaxy, the antimatter has been canceled by the excess of matter. But somewhere else, there's a whole lot of antimatter. We're suddenly going to start finding it. And I think AMS is now giving us some strong clues of that. So, what else is going on in space? And when you told us a few weeks ago, Paul, about the Chinese equivalent of their International Space Station, I'm amazed how little of that information appears in our news. That we basically don't know about their existence of their space station. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, and the good thing about the spectrometer on board the space station, it's good for the life of the space station. Now they're talking about maybe 2028 minimum for the space station, so it'll be up there a long time. As far as the Chinese goes, yeah, well you have to look at it. You look into their space program on the internet, you can find out what they've been doing. You know, they've, like I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, they've had a few manned launches. One launch with one guy on board, a small spacecraft, and then another one that could carry up to three, but they only put two on board. And they did a successful launch, you know, a couple of years later, and then a couple of years after that, they did the space station, which is probably similar to the Salyut space stations that the Russians launched, the earlier first generation space stations before Mir, and like 6 and 7 were successful space stations by the Russians, and it's about that size. So they went up, let me drop it. Three people last time, and they put their first woman on board, and they occupied that space station for a couple of weeks, and then left. And eventually there will be another flight up there. They plan on deorbiting it about 2 years from now. But they, you know, that's their prototype, and they plan on eventually building on that and connecting modules together and hope it. But they do a plan, long-range plans, as well as short plans. They want to do moon missions, no question about it. They want to do robotic missions to the moon and then land their people there. But that's their long-term plan. So I just want to mention that three things. This is WS2N Space Report. Before it gets any later, anybody that wants to contact me, you can contact Space Report. You know, my email, I'll give out, is spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. And you could always bring up topics, things of this nature, things that people that don't think about. We could always talk about on the net, but we've got the fun topic is the NASA's largest rocket, the SLS, the Space Launch System. I've talked about it many times. Was planned on being launched by 2017 on the first unmanned test flight of this thing. And that should, the news is that it's on schedule. It's not being delayed or anything. It's going along as planned. And eventually that will be launching people into space using the Orion spacecraft on top of it. And this thing will have more power than the Saturn V rocket. It's so much power. Let's say you wanted to do a Jupiter or a Saturn mission. Instead of going through these convoluted Earth or Venus flybys to get gravitational assist, you could just do a direct shot to those planets. And instead of a 7-year mission, let's say to Saturn, you can make it 3 years. So it's going to be a well worth project once it's built, this SLS Space Launch System. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Space Launch System will have the capability of launching 140 tons into space. So if you took a couple of small cars, you know, 2,000-pound cars, oh, you had a little bit more than that, but a couple of very small Hondas, maybe, and you would be able to take 143 cars and put it into orbit, low Earth orbit. That gives you an idea of the capability of this thing. It's an important number to remember, because at the end of the net, I'll compare that to something else. The second thing I want to bring up is Mars Opportunity. Not Curiosity, but Opportunity. The two spacecraft that launched almost 10 years ago, Spirit and Opportunity, well, Spirit quit about 3 years ago, but Opportunity is still up and running. And it's made a significant find. It found that there was a test on some clay where it's working. You know, they tested the clay, and they realized that it had the capability of being created by very pure water. And Steve Squire got involved in commenting on it. He was the original project manager of this whole Spirit and Opportunity launch back in 2004. And he said that the water that created this particular clay had to be very pure. It's the type you could drink. So combined with that information and the information from Curiosity on the other side of the planet, they're showing that pretty much undoubtedly, I mean, this is like the biggest discovery for Opportunity, that most likely you have a strong capability of supporting any microbes or life forms that could have developed billions of years ago on Mars by the work of these spacecraft, now Opportunity. So, now, again, this thing is not finished. After 10 years, we talked about this before, Dick, humans being sent to Mars would cost, trillions of dollars. Here this thing went, it was supposed to last but 90 days. Drop it. People thought the wheels were going to fall off, the antenna was going to crack, the batteries were going to fail, and the solar panels were going to just get filled with dust, and that would be it. And this thing, after 90 days, the warranty would be up, and no more Spirit or Opportunity. Well, Spirit lasted 7 years, or a little longer than that, and this thing is up to now almost 10 years. In 2004 of January, it'll be up to 10 years. And you're really getting a bang for the dollar for the price of the mission. Instead of 90 days, it's going a decade. So and keep going. And go for this other ride up to this other area on Mars, mile and a half away, which will actually beat a record by the Russians for operating unmanned vehicles on another world instead of Mars, though. It was on the moon, the Lockheed mission they sent years ago when we were sending astronauts. They were sending unmanned missions and would fly these robots around on Mars, the Lunokhod, I think they call it, and that thing got up to about 23 miles, and this will break that record. So in 10 years, it doesn't sound like much because we think of riding around on a car, but these things crawl at, you know, maybe, they're happy if they go 100 or 200 feet a day. And this thing is, it's the equivalent to going from the South Shore, you know, down by Sable, let's say, you know, through Ronkonkoma where I live and keep on going to St. James and out the other end to maybe Bridgeport, Connecticut. You know, that distance in 10 years, it's just phenomenal. And it will probably break that record now. The new location. The new location I like is because it's 180 feet high. Tell you, close to 200 feet, like going up almost a 20-story building. And sure, the scientists are all hot and bothered about checking all the different areas as they go up. You know, as you go up and on any kind of a hill or down into a crater, each area that they check it's like reading, you know, a different time frame, going either forward or backward in time of what the Martian surface was like. But personally, I couldn't care less about that. I want to see this thing get up to the top of the hill and take a nice panoramic view from where it is. I get a kick out of that, and that would be good. And also, they'll be able to keep it there, drop it, for its sixth winter, number sixth winter. It'll stay there, you know, inactive. It'll just sit there with the solar panels facing north and picking up whatever light they can get. Just, you know, it is south of their equator, so they'll pick up the sun's rays the best they can, and they'll try to make it through another Mars winter, and then a few months from then, they'll have another spring, and this thing will probably continue on its mission. So I want to bring that up. And one last thing, I want to bring up the launch of the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle, automated transfer vehicle by European Space Agency that went up last week, June 6th. It went up to, or actually hasn't docked yet with the International Space Station. It'll dock on the 14th, about five days from now. And this is the largest supply vehicle that goes up to the space station. You know, you've got many of them, the H2 by Japan, you've got now the Dragon by the United States, SpaceX. You've got the Progress vehicle by the Russians, and now, you know, of course, you've got the ATV now. And this is the fourth mission of the ATV series. They have one more planned, and that's it. That's the contract for the European Space Agency. It's launched down in French Guiana, down in South America. Drop it. Their largest vehicle, the Ariane 5 rocket. It's a very big rocket. It's got, you know, two gigantic solid boosters attached to it. And that's their monster vehicle that the European Space Agency uses. They're now launching medium rockets, which they're actually getting from the Russians, Soyuz rockets, and now they have the Vega, the smaller one for smaller satellites to go into orbit. But this is their big one, the Ariane 5, that's been doing it for years. And it launches